Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
Once
and
again,
together
we're together.
Walking Heads.
Dot TV, is it?
We're very much Tweedledee and Tweedledum, aren't we, David?
Speaking
of one of our topics later in this discussion.
We'll get to that. I think of you more as the Cheshire Cat, though, with a wonderfully winning grin of yours. Well, you know, this may be the last time we speak before the whole healthcare system is taken over by a socialist Bolshevik government. And we're working for death panels and life panels and in-between panels. And chips are put into our arms to monitor whether we've paid our mandates. And, you know, everything goes to hell. But, you know, as Barack Obama, our great president, says, the time for talk is over. It's time for votes. So let me ask you this question. You know, we could get into an hour or two of discussion on policy as we've done in the past. But it looks to me like even though the votes aren't all there as we talk, this is going to happen. My general rule of thumb is when something has to happen in Washington, it happens. People find a way, and I think the Democrats have to pass this bill. So what do you think the political consequences will be? As we go into the home stretch here, the Republicans are saying, ho, you vote for this, you're going to lose your jobs, which I don't understand. They should then be happy that the Democrats are voting for this rather than warning them. But do you think this fight will continue and that, you know, months from now, when we're after Tiger Woods has returned to golf, American voters will be fixed on this issue? What do you think?
Oh, I do think we'll be fighting about this for a good long time. I think, look, Republicans are torn. On the one hand, most Republicans are conservatives or libertarians, and therefore they're against, you know, big government programs. And so in that sense, they fight health care just because they fight health care. On the other hand, I think that the Republican Party the Republican Party would be worse off if health care loses. I think that that owning the health care
issue. They'll lose the issue, is what you're saying.
If health care loses, they will be worse off because they're better off. The Republicans are better off blaming the Democrats for everything that goes wrong with the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. Right now, in advance of the vote, which I guess is scheduled for Saturday now, they're saying, the Obama can say with good justification, you know, look, Anthem Insurance and whoever else insurance company just raised your rates, you know, 39% or 40% or whatever.
And the Republicans blocked us from doing anything about it.
Right. And that's a pretty good argument. If Obama can talk about Natoma Canfield, this poor woman in Missouri, I think, or Ohio. I can't remember where she is. Who wrote in the letter. Then Obama can, and then if health care fails, the Democrats will, as it were, govern from below and say, look, we're fighting the insurance companies. We're going to do it on a state-by-state basis. We're going to attack, you know, Anthem, Blue Cross in California.
What you're getting at is a dilemma that I think exists in politics in a lot of issues. If you vote to do something, you end up owning it. So
right.
We had this fight, say, with the stimulus. You vote, you know, just stipulate for me, for the moment, that the stimulus did indeed prevent the loss of 2 million jobs. But nevertheless, we still lost 2 million jobs after it was passed. So people could say, well, it's your economy now, Mr. President. Look, we've lost 2 million jobs. So if you pass a giant health care bill or a moderate-sized health care bill and you say this is going to make things better and some things don't get better, you know, whether it's fair or not, people can say, well, you're the guy in charge of the healthcare system now. You know, either you try to take care of this and you didn't, or you overlooked this particular issue, or you did, you know, make a stab at fixing it and it got worse. Whatever, you know, A, B, or C there, there's an ownership. And it's often better. You know, Barney Frank said this to me years ago after the Republicans took over the Congress in the 1994 elections. He said, it's more fun to be in the opposition. You know, you can just sort of lob things in, and if things go wrong, it's not your fault.
Exactly. Bob Dole, who was another canny legislator who, like Barney, although he was not an ideologue like Frank, but Dole certainly knew his way around the Congress, said, he was quoted in the Wall Street Journal, I can remember from the 1988 campaign, during the campaign, because we used it against him when I was working for Bush.
You never forget good opposition research, right?
Exactly. You never know what can come in handy. Anyway, Dole said that always vote for a bill that loses and vote against a bill that wins.
Yep.
For exactly the reasons you're talking
about. You don't
about.
Want to
you're
be responsible for anything.
Exactly. You don't want to be responsible for anything.
That's
exactly.
Right.
And Dole, you know, was elected and reelected, you know, senator and congressman and senator from Kansas over the course of, you know, 35 years, so he obviously knew what he was doing. It's cynical wisdom, and it plays poorly in public, in, right. in the public square.
But it does but create this dynamic that you talk about, which does make it difficult, you know, to govern from either side.
It does, and it makes it you need a large majority. And again, that if we're talking about this purely from political science point of view, if you want to pursue the strategy the Democrats have pursued over the last year, which is basically, you know, get the Democrats to vote for this, don't worry about the Republicans,
no.
Then you know the if you have to get 60 out of 60 or 59 out of 59 or whatever or 200 and, you know,
16.
Get those numbers. The last votes come
with a price,
unbelievably expensive.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what Obama went through with the Cornhusker kickback and
Dennis,
you know,
Kucinich got all the kibasa he can eat.
Actually, who knows what?
Well, it's vegetarian. It's vegetarian vegan kibasa. Okay. And
Luis Gutierrez,
yes.
the Democratic congressman from Chicago.
Yes.
Same thing. I mean, what he's going to get, whatever it is he wants, at least telling him he's going to get it as they pull him back into the reservation.
Well, I know that the last kid out of my house in the morning, you're willing to do anything to get them out. So this is a principle that I think Homo sapiens learned at an early stage. But, you know, I more or less agree with your point on some of the politics of this. But let me make a countervailing argument. Which I'm not sure whether, and I say this not knowing which way things are going to go after a bill presumably passes. I'm still working on that presumption. And that is, it's often easier to scare people about something they don't know about or that's not real, hasn't come to being, than something that is there. And the case that Democrats make, and I think there's some legitimacy here, is once the bill passes, there will be some immediate, as they call them, deliverables. This is what Tim Kaine, the very charismatic leader of the Democratic Party, told me at the White House this week. And, you know, they can list them. I wrote some down so I would be as smart as at least as they are. That immediately there'd be tax credits for small businesses. Insurance companies could not drop you if you get sick. Your child can stay on your plan from the age of 23 to age of 27. No more lifetime limits on or caps on benefits. The young people already. The donut, that famous donut hole for prescription drug costs for seniors would be filled to a certain degree. You'll get $250 to cover that donut. And there are others as well. Now, if these things start kicking in, and people start to see this thing immediately for what it is, and there's no one knocking on your door saying, excuse me, it's Thursday, time for your appearance before the death panel, then, you know, it may cut into some of the, you know, the opposition that's out there. That I'm not saying it's majority opposition, but it may, you know, water it down. You know, tempers may cool. Some people may say, well, my insurance company just sent me a note saying that my kid can stay on until for 4 more years. This is a big relief to me. Maybe this wasn't such a bad thing. So that all these things will become real, and some of the things that some of the concerns that people have raised, particularly about costs, mandates, some of the bigger issues, you know, how to expand coverage, won't kick in for a while, so whether they work or they don't work, they won't be immediately present. So if all this comes into being, the Democrats may be able to say in November, look at these concrete things we did for American families that the Republicans wanted to say no to.
It's possible, but two points of view that disagree with you on this are, first, Howard Dean, who makes the point, as he's advocated for the public option.
You mean President Howard Dean?
former governor, DNC.
I don't mean that. I see you around a lot. I like you. You return my calls.
Tim Kaine's predecessor is chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who says that, look, if the taxes on this are going to come into being right away, and the real benefits aren't going to kick in until 2013 or 2014. And that's been his argument for public option.
That would be
the kind of immediate deliverable that some people could see right away. So, and the other issue, and this I think is obviously I am closer to, is tell me exactly what's buried in 2,700 pages of legislation. And the answer, of course, is nobody knows except the people who stuck in those hidden provisions.
I think there's a secret moonshot in the year 2013.
If we survive 2012.
I'll give you some ammunition here. Even more to your point is one of our favorite laws, which is the law of unintended consequences. Now, again, some of that stuff and what's buried in, you know, maybe there's some horrific thing that happens on, you know, October 22nd, 2010. But I think, you know, I think a lot of this will take literally years to play out. And, you know, and there may be some things that happen in the short run, as I mentioned, my list of deliverables, and I don't know, what people see the tax hikes and associate them with the bill immediately and not associate them with these immediate deliverables. But nevertheless, I think the Democrats, you know, have a fighting chance of making a case afterwards that all that bogeyman talk from the Republican side, well, you know, I'm not sure they're going to beat it back entirely, and I think Sarah Palin will still be tweeting out there. And listen, how many cups of coffee does she have before she does each tweet? Those tweets scare me. I think the debate will go on. It won't be concluded after a vote this weekend or next week, whenever that happens. But I think the Democrats might be in a better position afterwards.
Maybe, but I would just point you to and Blogging Heads fans, Theodore Lowy, L-O-W-I, the famous
political scientist
from Cornell
yes,
who wrote a book in 1969 called The End of Liberalism, in which he said that...
I read that book in college. I was made to read that book in college.
Okay, it's a... You paid to read the book, I guess.
Yes,
anyway, Lowy's argument was that interest group liberalism, that was a term he coined,
yes,
as in groups wheeling and dealing with each other to, you know, get what they want as factions, is creating a kind of compound eye version of the public interest that is very unappealing to the voters. And that is alienates the voters because they don't understand what's in it, because it makes things complicated and difficult and arcane. And I read the book in college too, and I wrote about Lowy and the end of liberalism in the 1993 Hillary care debate. I dug up the column, it was in the LA Times way back when. And then I wrote about it again last year. And I would just point that to anybody as you want, the prism through which to see a 2,700-page bill. And again, it's not so much that I think there's some hidden death penalty.
Jim, what would be the right amount of pages for a bill?
Well, the Social Security Act of 1935 was 30 pages.
Okay, is that the top?
That's a nice number.
How many Americans do you think read that bill? See, I have a different take. To me, it's not the length of the bill. It's who's selling the bill. I think Americans rallied behind that bill, 30-page bill during the New Deal days, because they trusted and believed FDR, and they saw it as his bill, and they didn't care if it was one page or 100 pages or 30 or in between. And I think the mistake that Obama made, which I think we've talked about on this show a couple thousand times, is that he immediately, you know, ceded the details and the work here to Congress, which nobody likes. And, you know, the fact that a Congress and Max Baucus and everybody else, who a lot of Americans don't have faith in, produced a 2,700-page bill is the real issue. It's, you know,
I agree with that. I agree with that. So, and I agree. If President Roosevelt were pushing it. People would trust him.
Yeah.
President Obama.
I think Obama should have said, "This is, you know, my bill." People in politics choose their champions. And we can talk about champions later when we get to Alice in Wonderland, but that's two teases here. But they choose their champions and they trust them. And if, you know, Obama came out and said, "You know, listen, you please read this. I encourage you to read it. Let me give you the broad outlines, and I vouch for this bill." You know, that's, you know, I think would have made a big difference.
I agree. I have been struck, and I've been in this town for 30
years. I hope you have insurance. You've been struck.
I have never seen a Speaker of the House in either party who is on TV as much and as often calling the plays, as it were, publicly, as Nancy Pelosi.
Newt didn't do that?
I was around for that, and it is.
There was less TV in those days.
There was less TV. You're right. There was.
There was a lot less TV. And
there was no Fox, there's no MSNBC, there's no Walking Heads. I mean, but it just seems to me that Pelosi isn't such an attractive figure to middle Americans. That if I were the Democrats, I'd put her on TV. I put Obama on TV a lot more. I put Biden on TV more. I put Kathleen Sebelius. Yeah. I wouldn't put these members of Congress.
It's an interesting. Without picking on the speaker, I agree that, you know, their job is really, you know, difficult, as for any legislator, whether it's a D or an R, and it's a process. It's hard to follow. You know, is easy to parody. Just watch Jon Stewart any night of the week, and people who are distrustful, as they should be, of authority in Washington in general, you know, can look in and say, you know, I just don't like what I see happening, and but you know, this is where we are now, and you know, I think she and Reid will get this over the finish line. It will, you know, they'll consider it tremendous legislative accomplishments, and then we'll be able to argue at least about reality, which is nice. You know, what this bill really, you know, what really comes about from this bill. So, you know, I spent 20 years in Washington avoiding health care policy, and I think it's going to be impossible from here on in. But at least it will be, you know, not what ifs, but, you know, look at what's happened.
Very good. Well, we will leave it at that. Now, you told me once on the show that you avoid talking about Israel too. So let's talk about Israel.
Well, I always wondered what Rabbi Maurice Davis would say. Although he was very, very liberal back in the 60s and 70s. But I spent a lot of time.
Was that your rabbi?
My rabbi, a great man, a leader of liberal rabbis in that era. And I spent, you know, a lot of my days, you know, donating for trees to Israel. I figure, you know, that Israel owes me at least four oaks. I want to get, and one day I'm going to collect. For some reason, the poobahs at Blogging Heads TV want us to talk about Israel. And
since they pay us so much, we have to do what they say.
So we'll move right on to Costa Rica, baby. But
union.
But there was this whole, you know, blow up over, you know, Biden's visit there, you know, a couple of days back, and I got called into duty on Hardball, and we had for Hardball was a very long segment of 9-10 minutes discussing, you know, what this meant when Biden went to Israel, and as he was there, they announced the progress, the continuation, the development of certain settlements in East Jerusalem. It was considered a real slap in the face, even though the Israeli policy of putting a freeze on settlements did not cover East Jerusalem, and the U.S. had basically said okay in November when that policy came into being with that exemption. So a lot of this was kabuki, but it was bad kabuki, and it was bad for Biden. It was bad for Netanyahu, who looks like he can't control the far right wing, you know, parties that he's had to make a unholy or holy alliance with. But you know, in the last day or two, we've seen, at least I've seen, because I get the press releases, Eric Cantor, the Republican whip in the House, and AIPAC, you know, coming out with statements really blasting Biden and Obama, the Obama administration, for daring to criticize and creating any friction between the United States and Israel. And it looks like we may be back to the same old dynamic here.
Yeah, I agree. I must say that, you know, the Hillary Clinton is a smart politician. George Mitchell is a smart politician. And Joe Biden is, I mean, they're all three of them, you know, and they're probably the total terms of political service, you know, pushing 100 years between the three of them. And what made them think they could do this? I mean, which is not to say that their position
this being what?
This being tell the Israelis what to do on something when it's manifest that AIPAC has 75 votes in the Senate and 300 in the House or whatever the number is. I mean, it doesn't seem like it was ever going to be possible for an American Secretary of State or an American Vice President to get the Israelis to do what the State Department wanted them to do in a situation like this. In other words, some things in this world you just have to say, look, this is what it is, and you know they can do this, and we can't stop them. And so to complain about something that you can't win on is not usually, a very smart strategy.
Well, I take your point, but it does seem to me that in the last year or so, you know, one of my least favorite words these days is pushback. I don't know when this became a noun. I'm sure one of our very smart viewers can find that out. Maybe the OED has it listed when it moved into the vernacular. But it seems to me there has been pushback on AIPAC, almost like rapping here. And
with J Street and so on.
Yeah, with J Street, but also, which is I'd call it a pro-Israel lobby that, you know, takes a more peace now, or at least not a Likud position on things. And, Biden, you know, has said a couple of times, you know, last spring, there were a couple of speeches he gave in which he basically signaled to AIPAC, you know, we're just not going to do whatever you like. And there was some sense on the Hill, there was a lobby day that AIPAC did where they weren't as warmly received as in the past, and that some people might have thought they were pushing too hard on blowing up Iran. So it seemed like there was a little bit of a shift. We're not talking a paradigm shift, nothing major, but that there was a slight dip in its influence, and people were beginning, Democrats and some others were beginning to feel a little more daring in challenging some of AIPAC's
positions. Right, but let me ask you this. You are in close contact with senior officials in the Obama administration.
Not that close.
when Biden said, I condemn this action, and when Hillary Clinton called Netanyahu the next day, or whatever it was, and said, in 45 minutes of discussion, I condemn this action, did they think that they were actually going to reverse the Israeli move on this? Or were they just simply trying to impose a penalty on future action?
I don't think they're trying to reverse it, because as I said earlier, from a policy position, when Israel in November, called its unilateral freeze on settlements, it exempted East Jerusalem, and nobody complained about it, and the U.S. didn't complain about it. So from a policy position, I mean, from the Israeli side, the move was kind of stupid, because it was unnecessarily provocative and linked the East Jerusalem settlements now to the bigger freeze. So I think the Israelis kind of lost out on this in some ways as well. But I do think, the one thing, as has been explained to me by more than one Israeli journalist, the one thing that any Israeli prime minister really, really has to pay attention to is his or her relationship with Washington. The judge, in Israel, it's not an ideological position, but voters, that seems to be very important to them to judge how a prime minister is dealing with Washington. So I do think that gives any particular American president, some influence. Maybe not over, an AIPAC tied to Congress in the United States, but over the actions of a prime minister of Israel. And so making a stink with the vice president saying that, and Hillary calling Bibi Netanyahu about this, he loses face. And I think
you might be right. But here's a question. If the settlement, if East Jerusalem was not part of the settlement freeze, then then what precisely was the American complaint against the 1,600 houses in East Jerusalem?
Their complaint was that the announcement was made at this point in time when the vice president was there. I mean, it was they conflated it with the settlement issue writ large, and basically it was this isn't helping. The vice president is in. They knew whether it was part of the policy or not. You know that this is going to be considered by the Palestinians as a provocative action, even though they no doubt were expecting this because they understand Israeli policy better than anyone. So, but nevertheless, they would be regarded as a provocative action at a moment when the vice president is in Israel and touring the region, trying to kickstart what they call proximity talks. I love this phrase, proximity talks, because they won't be indirect talks. It's sort of like what maybe you did in high school when your pal Stephen thought that Mary liked him or hated him. You talk to Stephen, and then you go talk to Mary and tell Mary what Stephen said, but you'd put it in the best terms possible. And then you go back to Stephen and tell him what Mary said. But this is the kind of talks that we're not talking about the Israelis and Palestinians sitting down again across the table from one another, but at least having this shuttle diplomacy back and forth to move once again to we're all in one room type of negotiations. So it was, there was a mission here to get the proximity talks going. And when you do that, you kind of expect both sides who you're dealing with to not do anything that can be portrayed or that can be seen as boneheaded. And this was boneheaded. I think in the end of the day, it's not a policy move that's going to affect negotiations one way or another. I mean, the Palestinians no doubt have a realistic view of this, and we're playing this up for all it's worth. And it's my guess that this was that Biden and other Obama administration officials saw a way to sort of shame Netanyahu and maybe gain a chit.
I would say that it was a very expensive chit for them to acquire. They took a real beating in American domestic policies. Things you do sometimes because you're president and you're not in the opposition. Yeah. When you are in charge of things, you got to look out for difference. You got to worry about the world and so on. Did you notice, by the way, that General Petraeus, the commander of CENTCOM, has been urging Israel in the West Bank and so on be included in CENTCOM as opposed to UConn?
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah. Apparently, the CENTCOM, Central Command, which includes Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan and Iran and everywhere else in that region, has never included Israel. Israel's always been part of the European Command, which is a much lower profile and military delineation for the Pentagon. And so for Petraeus to say, no, Israel needs to be thought of as a part of the strategic situation in the Middle East, including all the Palestinians.
That's really interesting.
Issues. Yeah, it is.
He may be right.
I'm sure he is right. It makes more sense to put it. I mean, it literally is a part of the Middle East and Asia as opposed to Europe.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder internally what is going on at the Pentagon and the national security apparatus in general that says look, we're never going to in terms of our Afghan, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, whoever else policy, we can't think of this. We have to think of in the same. Israel needs to be in the same discussions with all those other countries.
Well, for you,
it's not really France and Belgium. It's Iraq and Afghanistan that Israel's in the context of. It's just it's perhaps a small bureaucratic thing that could explain a lot of
blogging heads, TV viewers. Pay attention. Call your brokers. This information might be useful in the future. But speaking of Iraq, Jim.
Yes.
I've sort of been drawn back through the wormhole into the debate of how and why we went to war in Iraq.
Oh, yes, you have. Yeah, I've heard about this. This is big time.
Big time.
Somebody was saying.
we can use the A word as well. Isn't that part of it? I think I can blame Karl Rove on this because his book came out a week or two back in which he insisted that the president, George W. Bush, did not lie us, those are his words, into the Iraq war. And I, having written a couple books on the subject, you know, took issue and wrote a couple of columns in which I listed the occasions in which the president and Dick Cheney and others either overstated the intelligence that did exist at the time or made stuff up that didn't exist at the time. Everyone knows that the intelligence was wrong and was flawed, but the intelligence was also full of many caveats, was sometimes contradictory, and regardless of what it was, the Bush and Cheney and others repeatedly, again and again, overstated what the intelligence, what the flawed intelligence even said, and as I said, they often said things that had no bearing, they had no foundation in the intelligence that existed, and in fact, the White House even admitted that the president didn't read the big intelligence summation, the 93-page national intelligence estimate on Iraq, which remains classified in its whole. I mean, parts have been released, but you can't get the whole thing anymore. Yeah, not these days. But he didn't even read it. My argument has been from the get-go that whether you call it a lie or not, it was a willful campaign of misrepresentation and hyperbole. And in the last day or two, drawn into this debate has been Peter Wenner, who is a colleague of mine as a columnist at politicsdaily.com, Karl Rove, and Russ Douthat, the New York Times young conservative columnist. All of them have taken issue with the Bush lied mantra, as they sort of derisively refer to it. You know, Rove in his book, Wenner in response to a column I wrote, and Ross in attacking the new Matt Damon thriller, Green Zone. You know, all saying that there's really no evidence that Bush misrepresented the case for war, lied us into war, with Ross coming up with the rather, lyrical analogy that what really happened was a Shakespearean tragedy. It was not a story of good or bad, but a story of murky tragedy that led us into war. And so, just this week, and we'll post it where we post all our self-promoting columns, I did a column challenging Rove, Wenner, and Douthat to a duel in which I listed about, I don't know, 8-9 examples of these misstatements and exaggerations and made-up stuff from Bush and Cheney, and asked them to give me a line-by-line rebuttal. You know, what are they? You know, these were not simple mistakes. These were not good faith mistakes. These were not mistakes made because they read or were briefed on the wrong intelligence. And so, the bottom line is, I think at the end of the day, whether you want to call it lying or misrepresenting or misleading, you can flip the question, and as I do to Rove and Wenner and Russ Douthat, and say, can you state with a straight face that Bush made a careful and deliberate review of the available intelligence in order to present to the public a fair case of what we knew and did not know about any WMD threat posed by Saddam Hussein? I mean,
I think I'd rather say it's Shakespearean.
I don't think you. I mean, if they can say yes to that question, and then I think we can call it. We can call an end to the debate, because if someone says the sky is purple when it's blue, you can't have a debate with them. So I don't know. Karl Rove was tweeting about Wenner's column in reference to me the other day. So he's paying attention to this. Ross Douthat, who's been a part of our Blogging Heads community, I hope he sees the column as well. And, I know Peter will. And, I'm happy to take them on, mano.
Sure that someone, maybe you and hopefully others as well, are keeping track of all these disparate data points. One that I saw recently, maybe you can help me remember where I read it, because I can't remember as I get older, is that when Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, met with outgoing Secretary of Defense Cohen in, you know, just 2000, 2001,
yeah,
you know, at the end of the Clinton
yeah
administration, and that all Rumsfeld wanted to talk to Cohen about was Iraq. This is you know, December, January, 2000, 2001, and the entire issue was, what do we do about Iraq?
Yeah.
Which again supports the storyline that some elements, obviously very powerful elements in the Bush administration, had dreamed of a war against Iraq, an occupation, a regime change, long before 9/11.
Well, there are a lot of data points in that narrative. Paul O'Neill, right, the Secretary of Treasury at the beginning of the Bush administration, said the same thing when he left. You know, there are several stories of Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Clark, who was the National right Security Council counterterrorism guy, who actually stayed on after Clinton and worked for the Bush administration, you know, tells a story of, you know, having briefings and wanting to talk about al-Qaeda as this very, you know, real and immediate terrorist threat. And Wolfowitz saying, why are you worrying about them? The real issue is Saddam Hussein. And then, of course, when 9/11 happened, Wolfowitz just, you know, banging the drum quite strongly with neocons on the outside, Woolsey and Gene Kirkpatrick and others, saying that this is our chance to go after Saddam Hussein, that he must be behind this. So that was all in keeping. This was sort of teed up, you know, before 9/11, before they even worried about WMDs, as I point out
right
in the
story. Right. And there's two kinds of fog of war. There's the fog of war that I think Clausewitz had in mind, which is
smoke.
You're in a battle and smoke, yes, and you can't see the guy next to you, whether it's friend or foe. And the other kind of fog of war, which is sort of more of what Errol Morris was talking about in his documentary on Robert McNamara, is the fog you kind of deliberately impose on yourself or your enemies, you know, throwing pixie dust in your eyes, just to confuse things. And I must say that, as I reflect now in the last 10 years, it seems, to me at least, and I haven't made a study about this, and I haven't written a book, I'm not so sure, on this, is They had the Iraq thing in mind all along as part of a larger plan. And so if that is borne in mind, then the work of the White House Iraq group, WIG as they called it and so on, doesn't seem complicated and ambiguous. It seems like they were just moving in a certain direction, which they did.
They were looking for ammunition, not the truth. And again, I'll repeat my challenge to our Blogging Heads TV colleague, Ross Douthat, and my good pal, Carl Rove, and my Politics Daily comrade, Peter Wenner, to sit down and we'll go over some of these quotes line by line, and you can tell me how they came about through Shakespearean tragedy or good faith effort on the part of the president and the people around him. But
or as somebody once said, following orders.
Yeah, following. Well, the president. I don't know whose audience is the president following. There's a higher father. But speaking of movies, speaking of Through the Looking Glass.
Actually, before we get to that, we should talk about the Ghostwriter.
I'm at a disadvantage because
You haven't seen it. That's okay.
I know my feminist friends will let me see Roman Polanski movie, so I have a problem here. But you saw it. And,
my
favorite movies of all time, literally one of my favorite movies of all time, is indeed Chinatown by Roman Polanski. So I'm curious to know what you thought of it.
It's not a particularly good movie. There's a lot of holes in the plot, which we could have a special spoiler edition of Blogging Heads where after you see it, if you see it, we can
warn
everybody.
She's my sister, my daughter.
Right, I mean, Chinatown was a great movie, and it was much better plotted than this. This has some real plot holes in it that are kind of glaring to me. What was striking to me, however, was the degree of venom that Polanski and whoever was backing the movie Hollywood-wise or international movie production-wise, because it is just taken as a given in the minds of the movie that the Tony Blair character, played by Pierce Brosnan, and the sort of unnamed American characters, including this a black female Secretary of State, are war criminals. I mean, it was just, in terms of the historical struggle here over memory, and, understanding, and so on. Ghostwriter may or may not be remembered as a great movie, but it will be remembered as a ferocious, maybe too ferocious, indictment of the people we were just talking about in the previous segment.
Well, we'll have to wait for Ross Douthat's review of that.
Anyway, on to another movie.
Alice in Wonderland, which I've seen in both 2D and 3D, so I'm up to 5D.
Why did you see it in different formats?
Well, because we took nine-year-olds and two, 10-year-olds to see it this past weekend, and I wanted to screen it first. So I took my 9- and 10-year-old to it a week earlier, just to sort of see how scary it would be and how creepy and whether kids that age can handle it.
But why wouldn't you see it the first time in 3D?
Well, it was just actually my older one requested to see it in regular version first because she worried it might be too creepy and that 3D okay. would enhance, the creepiness. It was a bit of time. But nevertheless, I have to say, I read some of the reviews. They were kind of middling. I give it, in 3D, three thumbs up. You can't see the special effect I'm pulling right now on the camera. But my thumb is now coming out and touching the nose of all those viewers out there. But I thought it was, fabulously imagined. I thought it was, I didn't realize this until I actually was at the theater. It's not the telling of Alice as we know it. It's a sequel. It's Alice 13 years later when she's 19 now, and she kind of returns to Underland, as it's supposed to be called, not Wonderland, and has to, become a champion in a fight between the Red Queen and the White Queen. And for those of us with daughters, it had a very powerful girl power message, which is, make your own decisions. And it was set in Victorian times when young women didn't often get to decide their own destinies. And I found Johnny Depp just delightful. I mean, that guy could play Dick Cheney, and I think I'd enjoy it. it wasn't the most challenging dramatic role, but there was something very hard. I think the accomplishment was that he and the woman who played Alice, whose name escapes me, I apologize to her, I thought really developed on screen a heartwarming relationship, which is kind of hard to do when one character is kind of a cartoon character. I understand. I've heard on the grapevine that you're not as enamored with this.
Lewis Carroll was, the original stories are brilliant, and there have been many good film adaptations over the last 100 years. It's important for would-be viewers of this movie to understand that they completely junked Carroll. They have the characters and nothing else. It's a different story. They have turned it into sort of the Chronicles of Narnia sword fighting movie, where Alice is a combination of Prince Caspian and Joan of Arc, and spends her time, fighting the bad guys. Tim Burton, the director, who I was a huge fan of Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice, Nightmare Before Christmas and so on, has taken a turn for the worse. I thought Sweeney Todd was terrible a couple of years ago, and I think this just, he seems now to have sort of lost his intelligence to go along with his visual imagination, and he just makes sort of bang it, in the case of Sweeney Todd, just bloody movies with sort of gore, Saw 6 kind of movies. And in this, they just simply, that was the perverse part of Sweeney Todd. They took out most of the music. They wanted more time for cutting throws, because I thought that would get the audience of 14-year-olds to see the movie. And this, I was just startled at how, A, it was pretty, I'll give them that, and yet I thought the plot was just bad, and sort of an insult to the original works, even though I realized they were also at the same time kind of an homage. I was sort of distressed at how bad it was.
I don't think I could disagree with you more, except if you were talking about global warming, which fortunately we're not. I just encourage viewers to go out and see it and decide for themselves.
Well, that's certainly a fair and balanced. That's very fair and balanced of you. What can I say?
But I think that brings our movie edition of Vlogging Heads TV to a close.
Right, well, David, when we two or three meet again, depending on how many D's we have, we will have a, presumably, although you never know. I mean, it is worth remembering that Congressman Clyburn said the vote might wait till Easter. So, you know,
which gives us one more chance to talk about it before it happens. I can't wait. Oh, joy.
If we weren't getting paid so well to do this, I could see why it would grow thin.
Anything that's good for Ezra. Well, anyway, Jim, I'll see you
David,
soon.
David, thank you. Bye. See you soon. Bye.